Food is fuel for your body, your mind, and definitely your sport. But let's face it, nutrition is confusing, and the expectations on girls and women to be thin and have a six-pack are exhausting. If you've ever been frustrated with your body, confused about nutrition, obsessed with eating healthy, or guilty when you don't, underate, overate, or overtrained, and overwhelmed with all the pressure, then this podcast is for you. Nutrition can be easy. You can take control of it, but it might start with letting go of control by asking for help and making a change. I'm Lindsay Elizabeth Cortez, sports dietitian and owner of Rise Up Nutrition, where I empower female athletes to overcome nutrition concerns and perform at their highest level, to stop being confused by all the mixed or harmful messages, and finally have confidence in your body as a fierce, fit, and fueled female athlete.
Welcome back. It's Lindsay Elizabeth Cortez, your host of the podcast, registered dietitian and sports dietitian. I am thrilled to bring our guest to you today, Amelia Boone. I totally fangirled out in meeting with her and like got all flushed in the face and my heart was racing. and there was no need for that because she is just such a kind, down-to-earth, patient, and just like awesome person. And it's funny too, because as I was preparing for this podcast, I was thinking to myself, you know, one of the many wonderful things about Amelia is that she has been so outspoken about her struggle with disordered eating throughout the years. And, you know, she became very public about it a few years ago when she entered into a treatment center. And she's really been a role model to many people in, you know, not being ashamed and just being honest and working towards getting better every day. And also just kind of enlightening the world that this is something that even athletes who are at the top of their sport and, you know, the top in the world and may look like the picture of health on the outside can still have these very serious problems going on. And they still need and deserve help for that. And so I just think she's been such a trailblazer. And we're going to get into all of that. And it's funny, though, what I was going to mention is that I went into this podcast thinking, I really want to like take a different angle, you know, as an interviewer. I really want to like ask her something different because I feel like she's told her story so many times. And maybe you've heard her story before. But in the end, I think I didn't ask too many unique questions because it's just so nice and refreshing to hear her share her story. And it doesn't matter how many times you've heard it. Hearing it one more time is just helpful from somebody like her who has been through so much and has shown herself patience and grace throughout the process and continues to be the top in the country, in the world, in her sports throughout the years. And so it's just really, really refreshing. And I really hope you enjoy this conversation. And I also, one more thing I want to say about Amelia is we did have some technical errors. And I think in the end, my editor cleaned it up nicely. But if you notice any of that, I apologize. And thank you, Amelia, for your patience as I had some technical errors on my end while we recorded this. So thank you. One thing that we did talk about at the end of this podcast, which I think maybe was a little bit different and unique, and I'm so appreciative of her bringing it up, is the fact that she's now entered her 40s and she pursued an athletic career for so long and also struggled with that eating disorder that she does not currently have children and is still unsure if that's a path that her life will take or not. And I think that was just a great conversation, and I'm so thankful to her for opening up that conversation once again publicly, for more people to have this conversation about the importance of having that choice. And I think it's something that as many of my young listeners, you know, that we're in our 20s or teens and we're not thinking about having kids, and that's okay. But this is one reason to really take care of your health is that you want to give yourself that choice later on down the road because you just don't know what's going to happen in life. And you want to give yourself as many choices as possible. So I will let you all listen to the podcast in just a moment. I do want to tell you about two amazing discount codes for Inside Tracker and Jen and Carrie. So Inside Tracker, if you aren't aware, they're an amazing company that can test your blood biomarkers and other markers of health and performance with your doctor. You don't need a doctor's order. You can just go online, insidetracker.com, and say, hey, I want to get this whole panel of my vitamin D and my B vitamins and my hormone levels checked, and you can do that. You can use the code LindseyCPro25. That's Lindsey, LINDSEY, C for Cortez, Pro, PRO, 25 for 25% off at insidetracker.com. And as we talked about the choice of motherhood or not, so many females struggle with this of, I'm an athlete, but I want to be a mom. And can I do both? Do I have to sacrifice something? Well, thanks to the amazing company, Jen and Carrie, if you are a mother who is breastfeeding, you can still be an athlete with their amazing nursing sports bras. And what I love most about them is I am not breastfeeding and they are still my favorite sports bras. I'm actually wearing it right now. I wear these things all the time. They work during the phase of my life where I was breastfeeding and they work during the phase of my life where I'm not. So you don't have to sacrifice being an athlete if you are a mother. Use the code RISEUP10 for $10 off your first order. And I know you'll absolutely love it. JenandCarrie.com, J-E-N and Carrie, K-E-R-I.com. Let's get to the conversation with Amelia. Hey, fans. I'm beyond excited for our guest today. I'm sure you already know who she is. If you don't, do a quick Google search. It's Amelia Boone. She's known as the Queen of Pain. She's a four-time obstacle racing world champion and a corporate attorney. One of the most decorated obstacle course racers in the world, her accolades include winning the Spartan Race World Championships and being the only three-time winner of the world's toughest butter. In recent years, Amelia has transitioned from OCR to ultra running, tackling unique events such as the Barkley Marathons and Big Backyard Ultra. She finds her stride in longer mountainous races, all the way up to 100 miles. Amelia is a staunch advocate of mental health, having dealt most of her life with an eating disorder and obsessive compulsive disorder. After her eating disorder led to a string of bone stress injuries in recent years, she entered treatment and recovery in hopes of getting back to what she loves to do, which is run and race. She brings a unique perspective on navigating disordered eating and athletics, as well as expertise in returning to running after injury. Amelia, thanks so much for coming on the Female Athlete Nutrition Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah, I am still like trying to keep my cool as I talk with you. I want to give maybe a little backstory too, just that, you know, I've been a sports dietitian for over 10 years now, maybe just 11. I'm not quite sure. But anyways, I established my own private practice in 2018 or 2019. And I think that's the year that you kind of came public with your struggles with eating. And it was as I was navigating my private practice as a sports dietitian, okay, helping athletes with performance. And I wanted to niche down to female athletes. And then it was like where my heart was really at and the clients I loved working with were the female athletes that struggled anywhere on the spectrum of disordered eating. Because in my years of experience and my personal experience, like I saw that that was huge. So many female athletes struggled with it. And then suddenly like your post came out on social media and some of my clients started talking about it. And I was like, see, this is a thing, you know, and potentially, I don't know how much, but I just don't think athletes were as vocal about their struggles with disordered eating until kind of more recently. I really feel that you were somewhat of a champion and an advocate for being open to discussing what was happening and what is happening.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, I've noticed this too in recent years that it seems to be the taboo around talking about disordered eating has lessened. Yeah. And that's different. And I think part of my rationale for coming out and talking about it was because I was so tired of hiding that shame because I had lived in that shame since I was 15 years old. And at the time when I came out to talk about it and went back into treatment, I was 35.
Yeah.
And so it had been a long period of my life that I felt like I needed to hide. And I didn't want to do that anymore, you know, and then part of me is like, well, I guess I'll go first.
Well, yeah. And I think you really were one of the first. And
you know, going back to me kind of branching out career-wise to helping in this space, I remember when I first started my business and I was talking to somebody, nobody, you know, important in my life, just like a person, and saying, oh, I work with athletes with eating disorders. And she said to me, athletes can't have eating disorders. Like, they can't. They don't. And I was like, what do you mean? She was like, well, they would have to be hospitalized. And I was like, well, maybe, but maybe not. And there's so, mm-hmm. like, there's so, and that's where I think where you experienced a lot of that shame was like, I'm athlete. I'm the picture of health and fitness. I'm a champion. Right. I'm, you know, one of the toughest athletes out there, literally winning world's toughest mudder right. races. How can this, you know, be going on with me? And I think that's what you really were so brave in sharing to the world is I can be a phenomenal athlete. I am a phenomenal athlete and I am still struggling with this as well. Mm-hmm. But Yeah.
And I think that that's, and it's hard because I also, what's interesting is that comment that you can't be an athlete with an eating disorder. That was kind of driven into me when I was young. And when I was first diagnosed, I was 15 years old and I was not a runner, but I was a team sport athlete. I played soccer, I played softball, et cetera, et cetera. And at that time, the model was, if you have an eating disorder, you can't be in sport because sport is going to exacerbate and make your eating disorder worse. And it was devastating. I remember being told I couldn't play anymore. And I lost those team relationships and I lost mm-hmm. that activity that I loved. And this was in, you know, the mid 90s. And so, but it was that thought that if you are diagnosed with an eating disorder, you need to stay away from sport. And especially running, because God knows running is only about burning calories, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I think for 10 years, I left sport entirely because of that. And when I got back into running and obstacle racing, and when I started to do that, I think it was in my mid-20s at the time, and I didn't know if I was going to be able to be in recovery and to be in sport. Because it was always drilled into me that you can't do this, you can't exercise, things along those lines. Luckily, that narrative has changed.
Yeah.
And when I went back into treatment, when I actually finally said, okay, this is still a problem, it was so refreshing to find out that there were treatment centers and there were dietitians and there were therapists who were like, no, we're not going to take sport from you. Mm-hmm. But we need to figure out how can you continue in sport and also take care of yourself.
Yeah. And I think there's so many different levels of recovery and treatment, as you know, and there's absolutely so many other benefits of sport, the social life, the mental health, that it's like just saying to heal your eating disorder, you have to take away sport is way too black and white. Mm-hmm. And especially at the level that you were at 35, when you went into treatment, you're at, you know, the height of your career in athleticism. So it's like this, you know, when you think of it as a job, you know, it's hard to just step away from that. And, you know, I'd like to backtrack a little bit. You mentioned you were actually first diagnosed in your teen years, but it was at age 35 that you went into treatment. Were you somebody that in that in between time, like, you know, identified with an eating disorder, or was more like, oh, that's of my past, and we were kind of like in denial of it? Did it take different shapes and forms? Can you just kind of shed light?
Yeah, it kind of morphed over the years because, you know, I was diagnosed as a teen and I was hospitalized at the time. I was not in a good place. And I went into recovery, but there wasn't, I mean, honestly, at that point, treating eating disorders was pretty much making you gain weight and then scooting you out the door. Yeah. There was no support around it. And I remember actually in college speaking out about how I had recovered from an eating disorder. And then I relapsed really hard in college. And I was in residential treatment after college. And so I had kind of been in and out in various phases. And I think, you know, and then after college, I was in treatment. Then I went to law school. And at that point, I was in recovery for a very good period of time in like my mid-20s and late-20s. And that's when I felt comfortable getting back into sport. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of been morphed over the years. And I had a fear getting back into sport, like what would happen. And I think maybe people could look at me and be like, well, she got back into sport and the eating disorder came back. And so that's a tale. But it wasn't as black and white as that. And I don't think it was actually sport that was fully responsible for kind of when I started to really relapse in like 2014, 2015. I think it was actually honestly more life scenarios. Mm-hmm. Some things about sport didn't help. I think with some of the publicity that I was getting, and I was on magazine covers, which was wonderful and phenomenal, but also you start to pick apart your body, mm-hmm. and that was an added layer. And so it's not as simple as that I got into sport and then sport caused an eating disorder. Because actually for me in obstacle racing, it was very much like you need to be strong type of thing. Yeah. You need to have muscle, not like you need to whittle yourself down to this tiny, tiny figure.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that highlights a couple of things. One, just a reminder that eating disorders can happen for a thousand different reasons and sometimes no clear reason at all. It's rarely as black and white as one thing. And we did talk about, okay, maybe sport can heighten it, but also maybe taking away sport could be a problem and cause, you know, you to dive further into it. So there's, you know, pros and cons of all sides of this. Another thing that you just touched on, though, is just, you know, the curveballs that life throws at us and how sometimes I think just life events, personal, career, situational, whatever it might be, those can very often be things that just take us down a rabbit hole. And sometimes food is, for many people, I don't know if you resonate with this, but a source of control.
Yeah. Yeah.
Something within our grasp, something that we can almost see tangible results with and give us a positive feeling, you know, temporarily. I don't know if that, you know, resonated with you, but.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think for me, when I started to really relapse, it was, I was getting out of a broken engagement. I was moving across the country and I ended up with my first stress fracture, major stress fracture, which was femoral stress fracture. And I started to spiral and I didn't know how to feed myself when I was injured and dealing with all of these life scenarios. And I think looking back, it was all of that together.
Yeah.
So it isn't as, you know, it isn't as black and white. And I have to be really cognizant of that in times when I do have more life stress or recently, you know, I had another big injury and knowing that those are the danger zones for me and being super aware of that to make sure I'm not going back down that spiral.
And see, as much as we, you know, want the best for everybody throughout recovery and, you know, would love that it's this linear path and don't want people to relapse, there's also something to be said about this being a process and you learning what your triggers or vulnerabilities are, where you need to put extra attention or effort when things, you know, certain things in your life get more challenging. And I think, you know, that can be something for all of us to remember is that, you know, when you feel like you might be slipping or going backwards, you know, what can you learn from this? It's not necessarily a loss, but something that you can grow from when you move forward in your journey.
Right. And it's not, I think for me, I also, for so long, I thought recovery was a destination that, you know, someday I would cross over into the land of recovered, you know, with an ED at the end, pun intended, and that I would never have thoughts in my head. I would never have bad days, that nothing would ever be in my brain about this anymore. And that is not what I found. I believe that there are people out there who do feel that way, that they can confidently say, I am recovered. But for me, it is constantly knowing that I'm always going to have things in my brain. But just, I have different tools now. I have different ways of coping and just not listening to that and being aware. And I, for me, that's going to be a lifelong process. I think also because I've struggled for so long, a lot of habits and thought patterns are ingrained.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with that. You know, I am okay with the idea that recovery is constantly going to be a journey and that it's not going to be black and white on my end.
Well, I think in all reality, if we think of this like we do many other diagnoses, anxiety, OCD, depression, or even more, even like those are all kind of more mental health things, but any medical diagnosis, I think we can take that same lesson of like, no, this is how I, this is how I function. Like, this is, it's part of me. I don't need to shame myself for it. It's part of me. And this is how I function best. This is how I overcome it. This is how I get through it. Okay, there's going to be times in my life where it's more heightened. And these are tools that I have, you know, to get through that. I'm a naturally anxious person. But there's times in my life where you would never know it.
Right.
And then there's other times when I'm crumbling. And when I'm crumbling is when, oh my gosh, pull out that toolbox, like get back to the yoga, get back to the journaling, get back to calling my friends again, you know, and like, right. you know, you really have to utilize that, those tools. And so, yeah, this is it with eating disorders, like why they can, I think, sometimes go on for so long too. There's many reasons for that. But one reason is, you know, when you're doing good, you're doing good, and you're just fingers crossed, oh, we're going to stay this way.
right.
And I think that kind of leads me to another question just on this topic of recovery. Like, what was the push for you to actually go into a treatment center? And you've been vocal. You went to Opal Food and Body, which is up in Oregon, correct?
Seattle, Washington.
Seattle. Thank you. I'm a New England girl, so I always get those two confused.
All good. Pacific Northwest, I get it.
Opal Food and Body, and they are well known for running a great, not only eating disorder recovery program, but specific to athletes as well. They do support that mission. But what was your kind of motivation of like going, like this is something you had been dealing with, you got diagnosed as a teenager, in and out throughout your 20s, early 30s. And so what was that push of like, I'm going to a center?
I mean, I think on the surface, it was really the string of stress fractures that I went down, like the cycle that I got into. And so I came off of a high of winning these world championships and switching to ultra running and winning races there to getting 6 stress fractures in 3 years. And every time I would try to get back into racing, I would get another one. And I would kind of throw my hands up in the air and say, look, I'm doing everything I'm supposed to be doing in terms of training smart, and I don't know what's going on. But in the back of my mind, I knew I was under fueling myself. I knew these things, but I kept thinking I could still be in maybe like a weight suppressed body and run healthily. But it just became apparent to me that something had to give. And I was trying to make changes on my own, but I wasn't getting anywhere. And I would swear up and down that I was doing better and that I was doing the things, but I just needed more support. And I think, but more than that, I was just so sick and tired of being sick and tired and so tired of my life revolving around food and thoughts about food. And I couldn't be present in relationships. I couldn't go out to dinner the night before races with people because I was anxious about what I was going to eat. Like, I just couldn't be present. And I think overriding even just the injury thing was the fact that I felt like life was super hollow and that there was no, because 80% of it, maybe 90 some days, was revolved around the eating disorder. And I just was sick of living that way. And I wanted to see if there was something better. So I gave it a shot.
Do you have an answer to that? Is there something better?
There is absolutely something better. And it's not magical. It's not like I went into Opal and 3 months later I came out. I was like, oh my God, life is so wonderful. No, I went into Opal. I came out 3 months later. I struggled hard. You know, it took me a year or two to find my footing still. But it's not a magical overnight thing. And it's something that slowly, like some days I'll look, I realized it's be almost 5 years. And I'm like, huh. No way. Like it's like you see kind of now I can look back and see like how, where it has brought me and how life is different. And I'm super grateful for that.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And, you know, going back to that comment of thinking that, you know, 90% of your day was revolving around the thoughts about food or the stress about it. And, you know, gosh, you know, you as a human being have so much more to offer to this world and to take from this world. You're an attorney, you're an ultra runner, you're an inspiration. You're just, I don't know you personally, but you seem like you'd be a good person and a great friend to people. So it's like, yeah, you really gotta, I think, and that's actually a question I ask many of my clients, actually all my clients when we first start working together, is how often do you think about food just in your day? Just how often? And I think for any listeners out there, just, you know, look, we're human beings. We have to eat. So you're going to think about food. If you're an athlete, you might need to pay a little bit more attention to food, but it still shouldn't be always. It shouldn't be 90% of my day. It shouldn't be, well, that's the first thing I think about when I wake up and the last thing I think about when I go to sleep, you know?
Yeah. I think that was one of the main things is that I realized when once I started feeding myself well, is that I stopped thinking, like, if food became, look, I love food and that's weird, but people are always like, oh, you had anorexia, like you must hate food. I was like, oh, no, I love food. But the funny thing is that I realized once I started feeding myself well, I wasn't constantly obsessing over it. Is that I'd be like, I don't need to plan my dinner 5 hours in advance. Mm-hmm. I can be like, oh, it's 6 p.m. I'm hungry. Like, what should I do? You know? Mm-hmm. And just the amount of brain space that frees up, it's amazing.
And I think that's twofold. It's one, the, you know, the mindset shift of, you know, but it's also actually the physical transformation of my brain is more nourished. My brain can think more clearly. You know, I can make more rational or sound or just thought out like decisions, and I can think about other things. And when your brain is starved and undernourished, it just can't focus.
Right. Yeah. And it's just going to fixate and spiral and loop on that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So a few more things on this topic and kind of going, digging into your past still. You mentioned anorexia, and I've also seen you post and talk about orthorexia, of kind of the terms that you personally associated with the most. Correct me if I'm wrong there. But again, disordered eating can look 1,000 different ways, and sometimes these terms don't always define everything.
Yeah.
But I wanted to hear kind of your experience and what kind of you associated with most, and maybe like your definition of orthorexia to you.
Yeah, no, actually. So I, the funny thing is I remember going into treatment facility and they're like, oh, you're an athlete. You must have orthorexia. Mm-hmm. I was like, no, I don't, like at all. Mm. Because what was funny to me is that I never, the eating, everybody thinks that an athlete must be obsessed with eating clean. And then they'd be like, but we see you, you eat Pop-Tarts, you eat like ice cream, you, and I was like, yeah, I don't have that. That's not me. And that's not necessarily how every athlete presents as their eating disorder, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's, I think that really caught people for a loop. Also, when I opened up, I remember getting emails. There were a lot of people who were angry when I opened up about my eating disorder, you know, to the masses, and people are like, yeah, but you always posted about how you would eat Pop-Tarts before races, and you were must have been lying to us, because if you had an eating disorder, there's no way you would be doing that. I was like, no, actually I was.
Oh, wow.
Like, and so I was like, you'd be surprised what people what people would get angry about.
No, you're like, right. I can't imagine being in your shoes, being vulnerable about this topic and then having people be angry at you and saying like, you're wrong. You can't have an eating disorder because you posted something that you ate a Pop-Tart. Like, how ignorant of people.
Or just that I was lying about it. Yeah. And I was like, no, I'm not lying. It's just that eating disorders don't look the same way for any person. And and anybody who goes through recovery knows is that like, a food that is quote unquote safe for one person may be a fear food for another person. And there's no rhyme or reason.
Yeah.
Like there is sometimes no rhyme or reason for that. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a conversation that people, you know, don't always understand. Or the idea that, oh, you have anorexia, but like, I see you eating. And I'm like, yeah, that's not what it's not like.
Right. Oh, and that's probably the biggest misconception I see with athletes, especially with, I do have a lot of my clients, over 50% are in like the high school, college age group. Yeah. And so their parents are like, she eats. They're like trying to convince me, oh, she eats plenty. We see her eat. I'm like, that's not the problem.
We all have to eat.
We all eat. She is eating. That's great. And look, there are some people that might not, and that's a different story, but like you can still have an eating disorder even if you quote are eating
I think and it's hard I think to identify, because my parents did the exact same thing when it was actually my soccer coach who was the first one to notice that like something was kind of amiss back when I was a teenager and talked to my parents. My parents are like, but we see her eating. And I was like, yeah, but that's not, I don't think we understood, you know, that it just was not enough to sustain what I was doing, you know? And I think that that is actually really the slippery slope that a lot of athletes get into, because you also just have no idea. And I didn't either, about what I was supposed to be eating and how I was supposed to be eating to adequately fuel myself.
Yeah.
I had no idea, you know?
Yeah. So it can look a lot of different ways. And yeah, that's why we do need to be cautious of just defining anorexia means you don't eat, or orthorexia means you only want to eat clean. You know, those are generalized statements and they might, you know, resonate with some people. But that's why I think at the end of the day, it's like, even if you don't fall into this clinical diagnosis, if you think you are struggling with food, if you're thinking about it 90% of the day, if your body is breaking down, if you think there's more to life and you're struggling to do it on your own, like, those are reasons enough to get help, regardless of any, you know, strict definition and fitting in the box.
Yeah. And that's super important, because I think there are so many people who, especially, they'll reach out to me and be like, well, I don't think I technically qualify as an eating disorder. And I'm like, criteria suck. Diagnoses suck. It was forever and ever. And I don't know if this is the same, but they used to only define anorexia if you were below a certain BMI and had lost your period. And which is complete crap, because like, you can be in any body size and be restricting. And I hate that fact that people feel like they're not sick enough to warrant getting help.
Yeah.
You know, like, I was winning races when I decided to go back into treatment. For, and people are like, how would that be possible? How could you be sick enough and you're doing this and you're performing well? And I'm like, but that doesn't mean a thing. So I do just encourage anybody who feels like ashamed that they might not be sick enough, like, to rethink that and give yourself some compassion, you know?
Absolutely. And so, kind of going back to the injury piece, you are somebody who, you know, has had lots of bone injuries, among others, I'm sure, just injuries happen.
Luckily, it's been only bone, which is a terrible thing. I can laugh about this because that's how I cope. But I'm like, knock on wood, my tendons and muscles and things have been fine. But
yeah, you know what? We can look on the bright side. That's great. Wonderful. Right. No ACL, no meniscus issues, just all those darn fractures. But with that being said, you know, how much do you feel, actually, I have two questions here. I think one is, you know, you are an athlete. This is your job is being, well, no, it's not actually, you're an attorney as well, which I don't know how you.
My passion. Yeah, I guess.
I don't know how you do that. Just amazing. But I just, how much do you think that, like, the decision to stay in sport despite the bone injuries? I guess maybe, like, did you feel pressure that you should retire or stop sport? Do you worry? What is it like to continue to train with bone injuries?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I have taken in a fair amount of feedback around this. Like, in my mind, it's never been a question that I need to retire or find a different sport or take up biking or swimming or something, which I do as cross training, but, like, it's not my thing I love. And this may be an unpopular opinion, but I would rather stay out there and try and compete and try and find different ways of training, like a level of training that cooperates with my body, and risk more injuries than just to take myself out of the ring completely. And knowing that's a risk. And also, it does, as I get older, realizing like that calculus may change, because I'm 40 now, bones are going to start to heal slower. Like, I always say, the great thing about stress fractures is bones heal great, and then your back gets a long layoff, but then you're back. But, like, that can change. So I've never wanted to give up running. But I think what I need to do, and what I'm doing now, and it's a continual learning process, is how can I train and compete and do what I love to do, but in a more sustainable way? And so, slowly, through trial and error, like this past stress fracture that I had, realized, like, we thought my coach and I thought I could handle more weekly mileage. We bumped up, like, it's very clear once I hit a certain mileage threshold, things start to break down. And because this has happened to me a few times. So I'm like, okay, if we stay under this mileage threshold, like kind of what happens. And so I think there's a lot in that that I think about and I consider. And also thinking about being in my 40s and having perimenopause and menopause ahead. Also, what does that look like in terms of keeping myself healthy with hormones and things along those lines? You know, there may come a point where I just throw my hands up in the air and like, I can't take the up and down and the heartbreak of injury. And yeah, I can't, maybe I got to find something else to fill my like love and passion and need, but not there yet. I still think I can figure this out.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's it. If there's a desire, if there's a hope, if there's a, this is still bringing me joy, then it's still worth it for you to find a way to do it in the safest and best way for you. And like you said, just learning like what your weekly mileage limit might be or what sort of cross training you need to do to help you stay in as you know, quote, safe as a space, which is important for any athlete, regardless of their injury history. You know, you want to respect your boundaries, challenge it, push yourself to the limits, but, you know, respect what it is you need to take care of yourself. So you're just kind of always navigating that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also taken into account, especially with bone injuries, is, you know, staying on top of bone density and DEXA scans. And I think a lot of people would assume, and I was fearful that I would have terrible bone density, but it's actually improved over the years. And so I'm like, I have normal bone density. And I'm just trying to preserve what I have, you know, through strength training and nutrition and things like that. But just a whole host of things go into that, you know.
So this is great. And I'm so grateful to you for sharing that. There's so much research out there that shows, you know, that the older we are, the less likely we can improve our bone density. But most of that is coming from, most of that research is research done in a postmenopausal population. And so when we have a person who is, whether they're 22 or 38, and maybe they have had a history of amenorrhea or having low estrogen for a period or even a long period of time, it's the fact that their body, I think, still has the potential to build bone and that, okay, if we heal our eating, we re-nourish our body, we re-nourish our bones, we get our estrogen back up, your bones can still heal. But so much of like the literature that we have about how, oh, if you have osteoporosis, it's really hard to come back from that. Or if you have low bone mineral density, it's really hard to come back from that. It's not necessarily in an otherwise like younger, otherwise healthy population. Right. And so I'm really grateful to you for sharing that your bone density has improved over the years to give people hope.
And I really, really want to hammer this point home because I was actually talking to one of my younger runner friends the other day who's, you know, in her mid-20s and has very bad bone density and is pretty hopeless. And I'm like, no, you have so much time. See, and like when I was in my teens, they did a DEXA scan and I had full-blown osteoporosis. And in my early 30s, I had osteopenia. So, you know, it improved, but not like it was still lower. And then the last one that I had this fall, I'm well within normal range. So I just really want to say that because people think that, oh, I mean, like if you are in your 20s, if you are still menstruating, you can improve your bone density. And so I like do not give up hope because I think it's like really important. Though running is not going to improve your bone density. You got to do other things there.
Other cross training, strength training is strength hugely training. Helpful. Hugely helpful.
And the main thing is really just making sure you're getting your period. You know, like that is like that is the huge thing for bone density for anybody who's premenopausal.
Well, and that's the whole thing, right? Going back to where I said, like the research might say that it's hard to increase bone density. That's in that postmenopausal. They're not having a cycle anymore and they're not going to unless, you know, they can get hormone treatment. That's a different topic though. And so in our premenopausal stage, even if you're not getting your period right now, your body has the potential to. So work to get it back. You can get it back. You can get that estrogen up. You can improve your bone density. Your body has the potential. You just got to give it that opportunity. So thank you for sharing that and congrats on your improved bone density recently. And it's something, it's so hard too, because you have to wait, what, 6 months or so for every DEXA scan. I don't know if you get it done more often, but it's like you don't have that feedback every day on how my bones are doing.
You don't know at all. You know, the one thing that you do know is that monthly indication, you know? And so like that. And so I think that that's why it's so important. I'm so glad people are having conversations around this now, you know, for female athletes.
Yeah. So these conversations that need to be had for female athletes, this brings me to another topic of a conversation. Another conversation that you've been public about is this concept that, you know, as a female athlete, and you mentioned you're in your 40s now or 40, and you know what that means for the choice of potentially becoming a mother or not. And I read your article in Outside Magazine. I'm so sorry, I forget when it was published now, but it was just so well written about just the complexities of just being a woman in today's society. And we're going after careers. We have amazing potential in athletics now that maybe, you know, women in the 70s and 80s had, but not nearly as much as we have now. So we're going after our athletic dreams. We're going after our career dreams. And then, you know, you throw something in there like your personal health and your personal life of finding a partner or not, which is challenging in today's society too. And it's like all of a sudden, oh, have I run out of time?
Right. Yeah.
And it's something that I also, I did resonate with that myself just a few years ago. I have been married now for going on 4 years, but honestly, 5 years ago, I didn't think it was going to happen, you know, and you start just not knowing what direction your life is going to go. And we make one choice after another and we just see where it goes. But we talked about like the importance of getting your menstrual cycle for your bone health and just for health. We need it for performance. And then this is another reason, though, that for many women, we might want to think about is, do I want to have children someday or not? Mm-hmm. I don't know if you want to elaborate more. I just think, you know, in your article, you just expressed all these different sides that it's just like, this is life and this is what happens. And I think at the end of the day, just what you phrase is just like as a woman, you know, you want that to be your choice. You want it to be a choice because our bodies have the potential to have children. So you would like for it to be your choice to have children.
Right. Yeah. And I think, and you phrase that very well. And I know I've had so many thoughts over this, on this over the years. And honestly, my feelings change and everything like this, but it was really a time for me and still is just like I always thought I would know at some point, like, yes, I want children, or no, I absolutely don't want children. And that has never been the case for me. And it still isn't the case for me. And I had always heard, you know, childless by choice or child free by choice or childless, you know, not by choice. But what about those of us who it more seems like a circumstance type of thing?
Yeah.
And then also adding in the athlete component and the disordered eating component. Like I think for me, a huge thing was thinking, you know, well, could my body even carry a child, first of all, given what I've put it through over the years? But more importantly, and this is really hard for me, is I would not want to pass this on to any child of mine. You know, I think there is a genetic component. I think that most people believe some eating disorders, but I also worry about the nurture aspect. And knowing, I remember thinking that I cannot have an eating disorder and be raising a child because I do not want to model those behaviors for a future generation. And I was super fortunate in that, you know, my family all had a very healthy relationship with food. I never saw anything that, like, there was no component to that there. But also knowing for anybody who is struggling with disordered eating or things along those lines, like, for me, it weighed on me that I would not want to model that for a child.
Yeah.
And so it was also a huge thing in my brain about deciding to go back into treatment as well.
Yeah.
Because like, I think if anybody is, you know, if you're thinking about motivations and thinking about like having that healthy relationship, if you want children is also super important. And I still firmly like stick to that. And I think the thing I think that is actually beautiful is I've had so many mothers tell me that actually having children was the thing that actually like really, really fixed their relationship with their body and their and food, you know, which I think is beautiful. But it's all, there's so many different aspects of this that were like swirling around in my head. So I just mm-hmm. need to like put it all out there.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of challenges to pregnancy and motherhood that could, going back to what we talked about before, life stressors could heighten an eating disorder, right. But it also can be an amazing, it is an amazing life change that you'd be amazed at what you can accomplish. And so those right. women who share like, oh, this healed my relationship, it's because there's a lot of life changes going on as you become a mother. And one of them is saying, oh, I don't have the time to stress about food anymore. Or like my body's already changed. So I'm not going to worry about it changing. It already did. So like that's yeah. over with, you know, and you just, you know, if you care like you do, you care about that next generation. You care about, right. I don't want to raise a child with this. So you, it's your motivation to change. It can be yeah. for many people.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, and I think it's a great motivator, that idea of making sure that, you know, whether it's your own child or even just the next generation, that we do our best to learn from our, I don't know if you want to call it mistakes, but just our life journeys, learn from that and try and do better for the next generation, including to your own children.
And that's also not like, and I also want to say, because I've talked to many parents and, you know, I can't empathize with this because I'm not a parent, who will reach out to me and say like, my daughter, my son is struggling and I don't get, is this my fault? Oh, and yeah. I think also you can do the best you can. You can model all of the healthy behaviors mm-hmm. out there and non-disorder behaviors out there. And you know, your child can still have an eating disorder. Yeah.
And well, so and you just said that your family was yeah. great for, you like, know, your family modeled food great. Yes. So these things yeah. happen. Yeah. Yeah. No, as a parent, and that's something I'm a mother of two young children, and you have to let it go. That not everything, like, okay, this, and my kids are little, but I'm like, okay, this tantrum, it's not because I was a bad mother today. It's just right. a tantrum. Like,
exactly.
They're their yeah. own human beings. They're their own yeah. people. And not everything is your fault as a parent. You just do right. the best that you can. But yeah, and then, you know, you also shared publicly about the process of freezing eggs to give yourself that mm-hmm. choice. You know, maybe you're still in this place of, I'm not 100% yes, but I'm not 100% no. And so I don't know. I'm living yeah. each day. But going through that process of freezing your eggs just to give yourself that choice in mm-hmm. your future if you want it.
Yeah, yeah. And I was super fortunate to be able to have that choice. You know, my employer covered a big chunk of it. I understand oh, wow. it's an expensive process.
Yes.
And, but I think that, you know, for me, that was also really kind of, it was scary for me, especially also because your body does change, not like pregnancy, but you are injecting yourself full of hormones mm-hmm. for a few weeks and your body is freaking out. And I was worried it was going to freak out my eating disorder, but honestly, it didn't at all. And that was very reassuring for me as well. And so, but you know, there is a lot there, but I think that it's also a beautiful thing that we can have that possibility now.
Yeah.
So, and I still don't, you know what I still don't have any answers, but here we are.
Here we are. That's okay. And I yeah. even just think, honestly, like sharing that, I think we're every generation is different, but I just feel, you know, that some people still have children very young, but there's a lot more people having children at an older age, not old, just an older age. I don't know what defines old. I don't know.
Geriatric pregnancies, as they like to call
yes,
them.
Yes, right. Which is anything over 37, right?
No, 35, I think.
Oh my gosh, 35.
I
yeah.
know.
Okay.
I know.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
That's called geriatric pregnancy, right? There's like anything over 30 is a master's athlete or, I know. Like, you know, so we're just these,
I know.
These terms that we need to, I'm laughing about them, but in actuality, we just need to normalize and be comfortable that this, like, it doesn't mean anything bad.
I love it. When I hit 40 this year, I was like, yes, master's category yeah. as an athlete.
Yeah. And it's, but think about that. There's some, you are proof of it. Like yeah. absolutely outstanding,
right.
outstanding female athletes in their 40s.
Oh my gosh.
It blows my mind.
Exactly. Yeah, I know. I know. Maybe we should call them master's pregnancies because that has a better ring than geriatric.
Yes. I like that. I'm going to go. If I have another child, I would go with that.
You're like, hey, doc, I'm a master
at this.
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah, it just and as somebody, you know, different than you, but as I'm nowhere near the athletic capability of you, but as somebody who has recently had children, it actually gives me hope of like, oh, well, maybe when my kids are older and I'm in my mid-40s, I can still pursue my athletic dreams.
Yeah.
Right? Absolutely. You know, there's, you know, where maybe pursuing the athletics and having children later is one option, or having children sooner and pursuing athletics later is an option. It's just like we have options. Right. We have a choice. Right. We have choices. We have options. We don't always have to do this like status quo, like this is what society expects out of a woman or out of an athlete in their trajectory.
And there's also the aspect, I remember going into the fertility clinic and the doctor telling me like, oh, 20-year history of anorexia, endurance athlete, there's no, like, your chances of getting a good egg retrieval are super low. Like, pretty much just shot me down. And it was kind of depressing. And my body actually responded really, really well, you know? Yeah. And so I think that I was worried that I had completely broken my system, and it wasn't broken. So just to give anybody reassurance out there, if you've ever been told that by doctors or fertility experts. So just clearly N of one, but there's hope.
Yeah. Well, I've actually had many clients. I don't necessarily market to help women get pregnant or be fertile. I'm helping athletes perform, but in doing so, I've had many clients who have wanted to have children, heal their relationship with food, start nourishing better, and then get pregnant and be able to handle that pregnancy when they, a few months ago or a year ago, didn't know if they could handle getting through a workout. And now they're, you know, so it is amazing what your body can do. But I also want to give you credit for all the effort you have done throughout the years of nourishing and healing your body and mind. You know, it wasn't easy. I would imagine it wasn't easy at all, but you did it. And that's why then you put your body through something like that and it was able to handle it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Amelia, I could talk to you forever and but I shouldn't because you have a life to get back to. I end every episode with a few fun questions. You want to play along?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, listeners, I have to pause and let you know that right at the end is when we hit more technical difficulties. And so our fun questions that I ask all of our guests at the end, we mostly lost. So I will tell you her answers. Amelia's favorite food that she could eat every single day for the rest of her life and never get sick of it is peanut butter. In fact, she already does that. She already eats it every day. And no, she is not sick of it. Her favorite sport to participate in is ultra running, but her favorite sport to watch as a fan is actually college softball, which is so fun. And I didn't know that about her. So that's awesome. And our final question, we do have that recording. So we will let Amelia answer. Amelia, if there was a female athlete out there that you want to give a shout out to for being just a role model or inspiration, she can be in your personal life or well-known to other people, who would that be and why?
Oh, man, that is, I know, I'm like, how do I even choose there? Okay, yep, I got it. Pam Reed. Mm-hmm. Who is an ultra runner and just, she's in her late 60s, I think. And she did Badwater, Western States, and Hard Rock.
I saw that.
Last year.
Yeah.
And is just that I ran the same 100 she did a few years ago and is just like life goals for me. Like I would love to be out there kicking butt in my 60s doing this. Mm-hmm. So.
And I'm sure you will be.
Thanks, Pam.
I'm sure you will be following in her footsteps. She's an inspiration. And just as we were just talking about, you know, entering our 40s, like so many choices ahead of us. And, you know, I think you'll be doing a similar thing if your heart is called to it. So, well, Amelia, thank you so much for this conversation today. Also, thank you for bearing with me and some of my technical difficulties. I appreciate your patience. And
all good.
Just thank you for being a great role model, not just as an absolutely impressive athlete,
but being open in your journey with life, with eating, with fertility, just all of that is so helpful to have discussions about. So thank you for being a catalyst and being open and helping others.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate having me on. So.
Well, everybody, thanks for listening. I really hope you enjoyed that episode. And if you did, if you are a true fan of female athlete nutrition, then I would love if you could support our podcast by spreading the word. Share a review on your listening channel. Give us 5 stars. It really helps get the word out and get the show more views to positively impact others. Also, you can support the podcast by joining our Patreon. Head to patreon.com/femaleathletenutrition to consider a donation, or even better, join our membership where you get extra monthly content and perks. We don't want you to simply listen alone. We want you to be a part of a community and a movement of fierce, fit, and fueled female athletes. So patreon.com/femaleathletenutrition is where you can do exactly that, learn more, and join. A huge thanks to our affiliates and partners as well. Once again, Prevenix, Inside Tracker, Orgain, Practice Better, Jen and Carrie, please go check them out and their links in the show notes where you can get deals and discounts. Last, be sure that you do more than just listen. If you need help with fueling, it's time to take action. Head to my website to learn more. You can either book a free call with me to learn more about our coaching programs and how we can work directly with you, whether it's the fast track or otherwise. Or you can take our online self-study course, Female Athlete Nutrition. You can literally sign up and gain access right now. You can explore our downloadable products, including the Red S Recovery Guide, High Iron Fueling Guide, or if you are a coach of a team, check out our brand new coaches toolkit for teams. You can also just learn more. We have a blog, a Red S quiz to see if Red S is affecting you. If you need help, I want you to get help fast. Too many girls and athletes struggle with nutrition, but you don't have to any longer. You can rise up with the power of nutrition, take action today in any of these avenues, and become fierce, fit, and fueled. Links in the show notes, and we'll see you next time.